of losing money in the stock market roller coaster? Frustrated with the government taxing you into oblivion? Worried about inflation? How do you prepare for so many financial uncertainties? Welcome to the show that will help you develop your game plan. The Financial Quarterback with Josh Jelinski. Josh is a noted financial advisor and president of the Jelinski Advisory Group, and he's here to answer your questions. Call into the show at 800-321-0710. 800-321-0710. Now let's kick off your financial future. Here's Josh Jelinski.
Hi, everybody. This is Josh Jelinski, the Financial Quarterback. Sean Piles is our guest for today. He leads podcasting at NerdWallet as the producer and host of the Smart Money Podcast. On Smart Money, Sean talks with nerds across the NerdWallet content team. Glad you could be with us, Sean. And for those who are not familiar with your work, describe what got you into finance.
Josh, well, thank you for having me on. And my entrance into finance was a little incidental, I'll say. My background is in journalism, and NerdWallet reached out to me at this point 8 years ago because they were looking to train a new generation of financial journalists. I knew how to gather and present information in an accessible way. And they said, hey, let's have you do this around personal finance. So I started with debt and dove really deep into that and eventually found my way into podcasting and have been doing this for a number of years now.
Great. And we're going to talk about your new scam series, also some of your travel series, but let's talk about scams. Let's just jump right in there. What scams are on the horizon? Pig butchering. I know John Oliver did some series on pig butchering.
I wouldn't even say scams are on the horizon. I'll say that we are amidst the scams currently because we are seeing record numbers of scams in this country. Last year, there were over 3,000 data breaches that we know of, and that's a record. That was a 72% increase from the previous record back in 2021. And last year in 2023, American consumers lost over $10 billion to scams. That was the first time we've passed that $10 billion threshold. And it seems like everywhere you turn, we're hearing more about scams. They were on John Oliver, like you mentioned. There was a big report in the New York Times about how a lot of scammers are actually people who were international and held in forced labor camps reaching out to us. So everywhere you turn, there's someone trying to dupe you and get your money, it seems.
Is there a demographic that should be particularly worried about scams? Seniors, 20-something? Things, millennials?
You know, that's a really interesting question because people tend to think that older people are more inclined to fall for scams. But according to the Federal Trade Commission, people who are in their 20s lose money at higher rates than people who are older. In 43% of reports, people in their 20s lost their money, and that was compared with just 23% of people who were in their 70s. But there's a big difference there as well, which is people who are in their 70s, even though they lost money at less frequent rates, they lost greater amounts of money. They had higher median losses. So this is something that really affects everyone. But one consistent through line of people who fall victim to scams is that oftentimes they may be socially isolated. They may not have someone to talk with. And that's especially true with people who experience romance scams, those pig butchering scams that you alluded to earlier. People want someone to talk with. And if someone is going to provide that for them, they'll reach out and build a connection, even if it's with someone that isn't actually real. So I would say more than any sort of age demographic, being socially isolated is a bigger indicator of whether someone will fall victim to a scam.
So for people who are not familiar with the term pig butchering, describe it.
First of all, I want to say it's a horrible term that I'm not really a big fan of because it puts a lot of the blame on the victim. It makes them into a pig that is butchered, but it's the best term that we
have. This is what they're called.
It's the best term that's out there right now, but it's a pretty simple premise. So you maybe get a Facebook friend request from someone who seems really attractive and you strike up a conversation with them. They build a rapport with you and then somehow they direct the conversation toward a money-making scheme. In one episode of this scam series, I actually speak with my father who lost tens of thousands of dollars to a similar scam like this. He got a friend request back in 2020, early in the pandemic when people were pretty isolated. Struck up a relationship with this person he thought was a woman. And one day she texts him, oh, shoot, I got into a car accident, and sends a photo of the car. And it's an Escalade that had gotten into a car accident. So my dad goes, oh, nice car. How'd you get that? And then they say, well, let me tell you about this money-making scheme that allowed me to get pretty wealthy through cryptocurrency. Next thing my dad knows, he's funneling a bunch of money into this cryptocurrency account. When he tried to get his money out, they turned the tables on him, said that he was in trouble, and basically took everything from him.
Whoa. So how long have you been in finance?
8 years.
8 years. So did he reach out to you? Because when we've had people, like one client I could think of who was in a pig butchering scandal, he didn't reach out to us. He didn't call us.
Yeah, that's extremely common. My dad did not reach out to me. He did talk with his financial advisor about it, who said, this seems sketchy, probably shouldn't do that. But he thought it was a better opportunity than his financial planner did and went ahead with it. But I actually hadn't talked with my dad about it in much detail until quite recently, over 3 years after it happened. And that's extremely common with scams. People feel a tremendous amount of shame. They feel like they messed up, that they're stupid. And the fact is that they were targeted by criminals and they were taken advantage of. And one thing I want to impress upon people is that you shouldn't feel ashamed. If someone took your money from you, you were the victim of a crime and you're not a bad or a stupid person for experiencing this. It's incredibly common.
Yeah, and one of these things, you know, when I got to talk to one of my clients who opened up after he was scammed, you know, you find out that they find ways because they've kind of befriended you for a year or 6 months or 3 months, ways in which they know you won't tell other people. So this guy, they use the child porn thing or something on his computer. Have you heard that one?
So they basically try to blackmail you.
What happened? Mm-hmm. I don't know if this is exactly pig butchering, but I've heard this a lot with our senior clients because they're not as astute with the internet. So it'll be like the Microsoft blue screen. Then it'll be like you know, you got to call Microsoft for help. Mm-hmm. And I've seen like that is layer one for them, I guess, to know if they have a sucker or not, you know, or somebody that they could really take advantage of. Because like if you're calling because you have the blue screen and you're calling some number, it's, you know, they're answering as Microsoft. Then they ask to get in your computer. So that was layer one. Mm-hmm. Then layer two was something about Chinese hackers were in. Then layer three, or Russian hackers, I've heard, or layer three was this like FBI warning, like we're watching you. And then this guy's freaking out. He was told to go to a Bitcoin ATM. So here's the thing, if you're listening and somebody tells you to go to a Bitcoin ATM to deposit money, call the police, you know?
Yeah. And the more convoluted the story, the less likely it is to be true. There are a lot of scams where people will get an email saying, oh, your computer has been compromised, and I'm extremely aware of all of these bad things that you've been doing on your computer, and you better fork over all this money, or I'll tell your secrets to everyone that you know. And one indication is that if they have to email you to tell you that they're in your computer, they're not in your computer. So that's one good thing to know. But when you do hear something that seems very scary, know that this is a classic tactic in the scammer's playbook. They try to get you to a heightened state emotionally so that you are reacting on impulse and you are not thinking rationally. So one thing I would recommend people do as well is if they find themselves being contacted by someone who's trying to put pressure on them, trying to get them to send money as quickly as possible, take a moment and pause and breathe and tell yourself in your head the story of what just happened over the past few minutes or days in communication with this person. If it raises any flags, if someone telling you this story and you heard it and you were thinking that doesn't quite add up, that's an indication to maybe take a step back, stop communication with this person. If it's a legitimate person who really needs your information or needs some help, they'll contact you in other means.
So who do they go to? They get this weird email on Microsoft or the, you know, FBI warning or whatever it is. Who can they call? I mean, we tell all of our clients, call us. We can help you. We have a cybersecurity expert that they can tap into. But what resources are out there for people?
I would first say don't contact the scammer, the person who is reaching out to you trying to have this sort of high-pressure relationship. Just cease all communication with them. First, talk with a loved one, a friend who you trust, and just get their read on the situation, just to get that gut check from someone else. And then if you are in communication with a scammer, you should always report it to the Federal Trade Commission or the Identity Theft Resource Center. Those are two good places that can help you identify what's going on and find your best way out of it, especially the Federal Trade Commission. If you have experienced a scam or identity theft, they have a whole kit that can help you recover from it. But really take a step back from whoever is reaching out to you.
You mentioned Gen Z. There's a 2023 Deloitte report that Gen Z is more likely, three times more likely to fall for scams. Why do you think that's happening?
I can't say exactly why, but my suspicion is that this is a generation that has grown up on the internet. And you would think that maybe because they've been so inundated with the fishiness of the web that they would have more skepticism of what they're encountering. But I think the opposite might be true, is that there might be a certain lack of media literacy, but it's hard to pinpoint exactly why scammers are targeting this generation more or why they are losing money at higher rates. But again, like I mentioned, they lose less money on average than older people, in part, I'm sure, because they have less to lose. But yeah, I think that they may not be checking their sources quite as well as they should.
Back to the internet scams, what are some other internet scams that you've heard of? So particularly people, you know, I think that is where age demographic, like the FBI warning, the Microsoft blue screen. And like you said, if they're emailing you, they're not in your computer. That was such a good point. Also, there's another one like where they go on websites. So the website is like, warning, warning, you know, and you basically just went on a scammy website. Talk about that. So a lot of these are websites that are just trying to see if they have a sucker.
Yeah, I think it goes back to the idea that you kind of can't trust anything on the internet nowadays unless you are trying specifically to go to a certain website. But there are some out there that are just fishy. So try to authenticate any website that you go to. If you are maybe buying from a new merchant online and you're not sure if they're legitimate or not, go to their about page. If they don't have a bio of an owner listed or a physical address, that might be a sign that you're dealing with a sketchy company, because there is a lot of commercial fraud out there where people are trying to buy something from a company and then they never actually get what they're buying. That's a big scam that people will see on social media. They'll get an ad for one product that seems kind of cool. They'll go and they'll do an impulse purchase and buy it, and then they'll never get that product. So try to check out any source that you can as well as you can, because we have a huge issue of authentication on the internet right now. It's very hard to determine whether who you're speaking with is actually the person that you think they are. And that goes from everything from a random friend request that you get on Facebook, a LinkedIn connection, even someone that you're trying to shop from online.
What about that whole scam? I'm hearing people, this is one where, you know, it could be cryptocurrency, could be something related to Bitcoin or something related to options trading or 500-to-1 leverage. How does someone know? I had one client say, "Oh, you know, I'm making a lot of money on this 500-to-1 leverage situation in New Zealand, trading currencies." How do you know whether that's legit or illegal?
A good sign that an investment proposition is an investment scam is when someone who you're speaking with or a website that you're on guarantees that you can make money, and they make it seem like it's easy and like it's fast. Josh, I'm sure you know well, and I'm sure you tell your listeners all the time, that there's no guarantee that you will actually earn money through investments. There's always the risk of loss. So scammers try to make it seem easy and like a sure bet that you're going to get growth on your money when you put money into their system. So that's a big red flag. A sign that a company is legitimate is whether they have solid reviews. I mean, obviously a good chance to plug NerdWallet here. If you can find a review of a company that you want to work with on a trusted website, that's a good indication that they are legitimate. But as ever, just be skeptical of any company that you might be spending or sending money to, and get some good reviews before you're actually going to go ahead with that.
You made a good point about when you're shopping. One thing I do is I go to shopping.google.com. You type in what you're looking for. So say, for example, Juan Soto became a New York Yankee. So I bought Juan Soto jerseys for my kids. The new San Diego Padre City Connect one, because I figured, you know what? He's not going to be a Padre anymore. Let's get it. Might become valuable. It's kind of funky looking.
Yeah.
And I started seeing, okay, MLB certified merchandise, you know, what's called the jersey, $100, $135, whatever it might be. What they will often do, the scammer, is like they'll pick a good price. Like, let's say if it's $100, they'll do for $79.99. So it won't look totally scammy, but then you can actually go and look the website up, see how long it is, see its trust rating. Any website lookups that you use? I know my tech guy was telling me some.
I don't tend to go to a lot of trusted websites that will just verify whether another website is trustworthy, but I do read a lot of consumer reviews on a website that I'm on. Like, for example, I tend to shop a lot of vintage from eBay, and you can tell whether a eBay store is trusted based on the reviews and if they have an eBay guarantee. So just look for authenticators on the platform that you're on. And if it's an unfamiliar website, again, go back to trying to verify whether the company is real or if it's just something that was propped up in a moment trying to capitalize on a new jersey being minted or one becoming more valuable for one reason or another, because scammers make scams in response to news events. Like, I remember back when the student debt relief was first announced back in the fall of 2022, I believe it was. And I was getting a bunch of calls from scammers that were saying, hey, if you give us just a little bit of money, we'll get your debt forgiven as fast as possible. And you shouldn't have to pay to get free debt relief from a government agency, even if the plan had gone ahead as it was supposed to originally. So just keep an eye out for that. Whenever there's something big going on, like around COVID, there were a lot of scams going on about getting government relief checks. So scammers try to realize that people are following the news. They want to get help navigating whatever is happening in the world right then and there, and they will take advantage of that.
What are some other key signs or red flags that you haven't mentioned that we should mention to our listeners before we move on to the next topic?
One thing I want to make sure that people are aware of are these wrong text message scams that you may have received. It'll be something like, oh, hey, Joe, are we still on for beers tonight? And you're like, oh, like, I'm not Joe, wrong number. And then when you respond to them, they'll say, oh, well, how's your day going? And they'll try to strike up that conversation with you. And that might be the beginning of the pig butchering scam where they build a relationship and try to get money from you eventually. But I think people should be aware that these scams are coming from all directions, and you, unless you call someone immediately or directly, you shouldn't trust it. And even if you do get a call that seems like it's coming from a loved one, there are all of these AI voice scams nowadays. And so you can't even trust what looks like it might be your kid calling you. In one episode, I speak with a woman who got a call from her daughter, and her daughter was screaming and crying, saying, oh, I messed up. Her mom thought that she was just, you know, having a bad day because she was at a ski trip or something. And then this guy takes the phone and says, if you don't give me $1 million, I'm going to drug your daughter and have my way with her and dump her in Mexico. And then as this is happening, the mom is freaking out. Someone who's with her is able to actually get her legitimate daughter on the phone, and they could put two and two together and realize, hey, this wasn't actually my daughter calling me. It was someone who used their voice to try to trick me into giving them money. So just be aware that you can't trust really any inbound communication and try to authenticate who you're talking with as best you can. Like for AI voice scams, people need as little as 3 seconds of your voice to create a pretty accurate replica of it. So Josh, your voice could be replicated very easily because you have a podcast. Your voice has been out there for a long time now. So what I recommend people do, even if they don't think their voice is out
there.
Hey, you
too, Sean.
I know, it's true. But what I've done is I've made a safe phrase with my family. And so if they do get a call from me and I'm in crisis, allegedly, they'll say, what's the safe phrase? And I'll tell it to them. And it's a bit of a tragedy that we have to be at this point where that's how we authenticate something is really going on. But that's just the world we live in. And you have to do things to keep yourself safe.
Yeah. What about all these, you know, Fidelity or this and that, that they're using now voice authentication in some regard? I don't like that.
You know, it feels a little gross, right? You don't want to give a company more of your information, but from the experts that I've spoken with, biometric verification, whether it's through a scan of your hand, like Amazon is doing that now for shopping, or your voice or your thumbprint, or maybe your iris scan one day, retinal scan, those are going to be some of the best ways you can prove that you are who you say you are. So while it feels a little bit icky, I think it's better than having someone get access to your information fraudulently.
What about the old-fashioned, you know, signature, wet signature? I think we got to go back to that.
You can I wish we could, but we're all so remote digitally. How do you do that? Yeah, you need to, even if you do it on your trackpad on your computer, someone could just copy and paste that image. So it's too easy to copy it.
Yeah, it's crazy that we live in this type of world. What protections are the government, what regulations are they considering against scams? I mean, I generally think the government does nothing well. So whatever they come up with, some criminal will figure some way around. Like they came up with the e-doc legislation where, you know, e-signatures are valid. And now there's all these other things that people could do.
Yeah, unfortunately, there isn't any sort of coordinated legislative effort right now to fight this. There is some talk in even state legislators around identifying and specifying that AI is a weapon when it's used in a crime like this. And so the punishment will be harsher than just using AI in this way as it currently is. So that's one thing that the government may be going to be doing. But right now, there isn't a lot of proactive movement at the federal level to stop AI from being abused in this way.
What about people who say, well, I won't give my financial institution my email. I won't set up an online account. That will protect me. Have you ever heard that? I mean, generally, it's people over a certain age, but that's... Mm-hmm.
Well, that doesn't mean that they're not at risk, though. People can still get your information if you're mailing a check. In some ways, that could be easier because they can just open a piece of mail versus trying to get your credentials online. So if they do want to avoid online communication, I would say do what they can to protect themselves where they are vulnerable. So try to mail things as safely as you can if that is how you're going to be sending out money. But honestly, going analog might not be a bad idea nowadays.
My thought was, well, then couldn't you just create, let's say that was you. You're going analog. Sean Piles is going completely analog. I love the, it kind of is a cool appeal. But then somebody could just create a SeanPiles@gmail.com account and then register. You know, they could hack into your mail, get your, you know, whatever, Fidelity statement. So I think in some ways, not having an online account might expose you more because then you won't know if somebody's trying to get in your account. At least with online, you could get multi-factor authentication. I mean, that's one tip. Make sure you have multi-factor authentication on everything. I was just thinking.
Yeah, I think that's a good point because you do want to be proactive and cover those accounts as you can, especially for something like maybe your retirement fund or your bank account in general, because even if people aren't accessing these accounts regularly or using a lot of online banking, they should know that it would be fairly easy for someone to try to make an account in their name, because at this point, we should all assume that our social security numbers or other private information, quote unquote, private information is available if someone wanted to get it. I mean, think back to the Equifax hack in 2017. The information of 147 million people was exposed in that single event. So wow. People's information is out there. It could be abused in that way. So it's a smart idea to try to make as many accounts as you can where you are banking to get ahead of that and make it harder for someone else to make an account in your name.
Hey, this is Josh Jelinski, the financial quarterback. We'll be back after these messages. The 10% Happier podcast is one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? Hosted by Dan Harris, a journalist who had a panic attack on national television and then set out on a journey of transformation. He's now on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. I sound a little bit like him. Every week, Dan talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity in wide-ranging topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. The interviews cover everyone from Brené Brown to Alexander Draymond to Sam Harris. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. Find 10% Happier wherever you listen to podcasts.
Tune in to the financial quarterback, Josh Jelinski, then learn how to protect your financial future in a down economy. Josh and his team at the Jelinski Advisory Group can help you lower your taxes and lower your risk in these uncertain times with a 27-point checklist designed to improve your financial health. Whether you're worried about runaway prices, fear of an upcoming recession, or a stock market meltdown, tune in to The Financial Quarterback and count on Josh Chelinski to call the play. For a free copy of Josh's book, The Retirement Reality Check, call 888-988-5674. That's 888-988-5674. Or visit chelinski.org. That's J-A-L-I-N-S-K-I.org.
Now, what about, this is an interesting scam I heard of. I'm not sure if you've heard of this one. We actually uncovered it and saved somebody a lot of money who was listening. So we'll call them, Person X. Person X had a large retail brokerage account. We'll say it's Fidelity with their advisor. They then created another Fidelity account without an advisor. Because when you're transferring or Schwab to Schwab, because a lot of advisors use Schwab or Fidelity, but then they also have a retail division. When you're transferring money from retail to advisor or advisor to retail, when you go from retail, Fidelity to advisor, you have to physically authorize that with a change advisor form. You don't have to do it when you're going the reverse. So what we discovered was the person was, the hacker or scammer was creating a separate, so the same institution, the same data, and then doing an internal transfer that then was going out to another account. So that's why you got to watch all that stuff. Because there's...
Yeah, that's a good reminder to try to protect your accounts as best you can. That really does mean do not have the same password for multiple accounts, because if a hacker, a scammer of some sort gets one of your passwords, there's software they can use to automatically run through all these other platforms and just get in right then and there. It's hard to say how this scammer was able to do what you're just describing, but one thing that's really hard about scams is and fighting against them is that you have to be right 100% of the time to keep yourself safe. And the scammer only has to be right a single time. So it's worth doing a little bit of due diligence now while you can to protect yourself.
Well, the reason it happens is, okay, if you're Fidelity Retail or Schwab Retail, they want the relationship. They don't want the money out the door. So they make it very easy to fire the advisor. They call it removing your G number. And there's no cue to do that. You could do that instantaneously. So if somebody has a RIA relationship with one Fidelity advisor, they can remove the G number. Wait, how quick, Jim? Instantaneously or within 24 hours? And they often don't even notify the advisor, so the advisor can't check. So this scammer knew enough about Fidelity's protocol and then Schwab's protocol, and they knew all the data of this person to where they literally created a separate account that they then could withdraw out from at Schwab. So it was going Fidelity Institutional, Fidelity Retail out to Schwab. So that's why you're very careful. And here's what I would do. If you're ever removing a G number, understand that mechanism, because there's a lot of things that Fidelity or Schwab, because you got to realize all brokerage accounts are now very low margin for these brokerage companies. I just got a phone with a Fidelity exec on Monday. Did you hear about this change? You got to hear about this change. They're mandating all advisors in America keep non-retirement accounts at what's called FCash, which is 2.26% rate of return, instead of the, I don't know how they're allowed to do this, but they're allowed to do this, instead of FDRXX, which is the traditional 5%, the prevailing short-term money market rates. And when I say, how can you do this? I call them, Fidelity, why are you doing this, guys? They go, well, you're the fiduciary. We aren't. We are a custodian. We are in the business of making money, essentially. So I don't know if you can use your nerd wallet.
So
you know,
what's stopping someone from going and putting their money in a different account where they can get a higher yield?
Well, they can, but you got to know that. Most people, they're used to, one of the better things about Fidelity, you know, Vanguard does this too, you know, they have their high yield money markets that if you're, so many people are just mindless about their accounts and they let it sit for a year or two before they even look at their statement. And now with online access, they're not getting monthly statements anymore. So because they've gone from, you know, $10 a trade or $5 a trade to zero commission trading, to get zero commission trading, you have to agree to paperless. So you're not getting statements. So the client doesn't know they make the switch. Isn't it crazy? So
it's not technically a scam, but it seems awfully close to it.
No, it's not a scam. And they're saying, well, all people were grandfathered in. So if you created an on, but to me, it's like,
it's a good reminder to shop around at least every 6 months. If you're really not feeling up to shopping around, maybe every 9 or 12 months to make sure that you are getting the best rate on your accounts like that, because there's so many other companies out there that are competitive and will give you a better rate than what you just described.
Yeah, or Advar, our clients just call us, because all it takes is we, but they're just making us purchase it, almost like purchasing a mutual fund. So mm-hmm. You got to go in there, change Fcash to the high yield money market. But it's like, really? You know, it's just,
they're trying to get creative to make some money.
I always said this commission free trading won't end up well, because what it'll do is bankrupt all the competition, and then they'll start raising margins, and then we'll be back to, you know,
yeah,
no competition.
Pendulum will swing back the other way.
Yeah. So what other things related to scams haven't we talked about that our listeners need to know before we get to your series on travel?
Yeah, I mean, I think the main thing is really just to remember that everyone is vulnerable to scams, no matter how savvy you think you might be. It's something where you may not even realize that you've fallen victim to a scam until it's too late. I speak with one woman in an episode who had her line of credit accessed by a scammer. She doesn't know how they got into her account. So it's on us, unfortunately, to be diligent, to be aware of what's going on with our accounts and be aware of what's going on with scammers too, so we can try to keep ourselves safe. And that's really the main thing, is just be aware of what's going on so that you hopefully are less of a victim.
We're with NerdWallet Smart Money podcaster Sean Piles. You can download his podcast, subscribe, wherever you get your podcasts from, Apple, Spotify.
But we are on YouTube as well. We have videos of our episodes up there. So I recommend folks check those out too.
So we're kind of moving from scams, which is your latest series, to your old series, which is fun, travel. Take us somewhere nice with travel tips. What are some travel tips you learned that you didn't know from doing the podcast?
So in the latest travel series that we have, we talk about group travel specifically. And in one episode, we interview one of our internal nerds who's planning a camping trip with, I think I want to say it was like 70 people. And one of the main things that I took away from that conversation was just the importance of flexibility. Because when you have so many different people with so many different interests, you need to make an itinerary that encompasses everyone, but also allows people to go and do what they want. And that way you can have a good balance of having time together, but also kind of feeling a little independent as well. So that's just the main takeaway as ever with doing any kind of trip, is just knowing what you want, know how you can do it, but build in some flexibility so you're not too rigid with what you're setting out to do.
How many people go with groups? I've done with groups and I don't know if I'll ever do it again. You know, you go with family members. So for years, you know, we'd go spend 4 weeks with my in-laws at various things. And then as the families are getting too big, you know, you can't all fit in a house. Everybody keeps fighting. You know, it's like, give it a rest.
I think that speaks to the importance of being flexible again, and also realizing, hey, if you're going to do a big family trip where you have multiple families getting together, maybe get your own Airbnb and then you can meet up for an excursion one day. You're going to a museum, going on a hike or something. But then at the end of the day, you can go back, have your own separate space and decompress a little bit, because I love to travel with a group. I travel with my college friends at least a couple times a year, but we are all very on the same page around that. Like, we know how we want to go and do something during the day, but also I'm really big on a mid-afternoon nap sometimes. So they will understand that, hey, Sean's got to rest for 20 minutes and then we can go and do something else, but I'm going to read my book in the meantime. It's just understanding who you're with, what they want out of this trip too, and getting on the same page.
Mid-afternoon nap, that would be nice.
Ideally, yeah. It doesn't happen every day, but you know, sometimes you can squeeze one in.
It's funny, I did that at college regularly because I had a professor who said it would help productivity and all these, you know. His name was Edward Panosian. I think he was somehow connected to the Florsheim shoe fortune. He, you know, interesting guy, great historian. And he even taught me how to sleep better. So what other trips for group travel do you have?
Cruises are a big one because it automates a lot of your itinerary for you. And full disclosure, I'm not a cruise person. It doesn't really appeal to me. I get a little claustrophobic. So for people who are into it, though, it can be great because you can have people who have different like modes of getting around. Maybe if grandma isn't as mobile anymore, she can hang out by the pool. If there are kids with you, they can go to the kids area. That's just a nice way where you can see some sights, you can have shared moments together, but everyone does get a little bit of what they want and there isn't as much pinning down, oh, okay, we're going to this restaurant this night or this event during this time of day. It covers so much of that for you. And when you're doing a trip with a lot of different people, you kind of want to narrow down as many decisions as you're going to be making so you can just enjoy the time that you're there together.
And then as it relates to travel, before we move on to, I know you're big into consumer debt, personal finances, tips for the younger generation. Any other travel tips?
I mean, we're big on credit cards at NerdWallet, of course. So if you are going to book travel, try to use a card that really gets you as many points as you can for the travel that you're booking, or make use of the points that you do have and so that we can effectively get a free night at a hotel or maybe make the cost of a cruise a little bit more manageable by using just the right credit card. So be thoughtful with what you're doing there too.
What are your favorite credit cards? What are your go-to credit cards for travel?
So I'm a pretty lazy credit card guy. There are some nerds that I work with who have a binder full of credit cards and a spreadsheet to manage them. I use two credit cards primarily, and I don't know if I want to say them specifically. I don't want to seem like I'm endorsing them, but I use the ones that make it so I get as many points as I can where I'm shopping. So for me, it's I'm getting DoorDash, I'm going out to eat, and I'm getting the points that I can from there. And that just makes it more manageable for me. And I know I'm getting some points, but not spending too much time thinking about it. Yeah.
I find that, you know, I had these guys, you know, the credit card point guy and this guy and that guy. I would caution people. I was getting into that. And I kept buying credit cards, getting, you know, and you get a $350 fee or a $500 fee. And this, I would say you get one or two, you know, or I think two. I think you need a good Amex card and maybe a good, you know, Capital One type card or Chase or one you're going to really manipulate. Like, so for us, we have seven kids. So buying nine tickets on Amex, do you know how hard that is? I've only done that successfully once, just this year. I'm very proud of myself. And it was annoying because they give you, I don't like the Amex system. You can rack up the points very easily. But so to fly from Newark to Hawaii, I got it free for all nine people. So that was good too. But
congrats. That's a feat.
And all my points paid for. That was the first time I've ever been successful at it. But I had to leave at like 6 a.m. from Hawaii to get back at 6 a.m. the next day in Newark. And that really like takes the fun out of vacation because then you're back and you're totally wiped.
Yeah.
So
there can be some compromises because you might not have as much flexibility with what flight you're going to book if you're only going through points.
Whereas what I like about Capital One, even though you don't rack up as many points, it's like two times points or whatever, I can buy whatever tickets I can. So I can go direct on Hawaiian or United and and change things easily. Where they say with Amex, you can change your flight, you really can't because it's a certain award travel fare and It's very tough.
It can be a big pain. And one thing I'll caution people about as well, especially if they're using a card that has an annual fee, make sure you're getting all the perks from that card, because sometimes you can make these cards pay for themselves just by using the monthly benefits or whatever they may be offering you. Like getting TSA PreCheck, for example, is a common perk. Use that and make it so that if you're paying an annual fee, especially if it's north of $300, I mean, some are over $600 at this point, really take the time so that you're not just paying that for nothing.
Yeah, you know, like the Platinum card, I think on Amex has the free pre-check or one of those. But I find, how do they pay for that? Like, what's the mechanism? You just pay for it with your card and call them and they erase it?
I believe you do get a credit for it. I haven't gone through that process myself. But yeah, that's a good question.
Because I was thinking, I was all excited about that. So I think I did that one. And I don't think I've used half the benefits. You know, I got, I might have got Walmart Plus or something. Because then you, to get the perk, you have to use that card for that perk or else they won't. But yeah, there are some really good ones. And I know some guys who are into, or ladies are into Chase. Mm-hmm. I just know the Capital One ecosystem in Amex. That's, I think, too. When you're in one ecosystem, stay in one ecosystem, because then you become kind of an expert at that ecosystem. So I was new to Amex. And after trying for so many times and failing, then I kind of figured, okay, I need to book. So for us, it was Hawaii. I needed to book it 4 months prior to the flight for it to really. But if you wait like 2 months before, it's done. Where with Capital One, you could wait till 2 months or a month, because sometimes the price, the airfares drop, because I like that one. But that's interesting. Any other credit card tips? This is great.
If you are using a card that has an annual fee and you're finding that you're just not using it as much as you want to, or you're not getting enough perks to offset the cost of the annual fee, before the annual fee is due again, you can call them and try to negotiate down the price of that annual fee. The worst they can say is no. They might not cut the entire cost of it, but you might get a little bit of a discount. And if they're really not going to budge, or you find you're really just not using the card all that much, you can ask for what's called a product change. And they may be able to give you a different card in their lineup that doesn't have an annual fee, but you'll basically still keep the same credit line, so it won't affect your credit profile in any significant way.
Oh, that's a great one. So let's go to younger generation finances. You've recommended the 50-30-20 budgeting method. What is that? And who might you recommend that to?
So the 50-30-20 budget is a framework where you allocate half of your income to cover essentials. That's things like food and rent. 30% goes towards wants, that's dinner out with friends or vacations, and then 20 goes towards debt payment and savings. And the framework, I think at this point, is more of an ideal for a lot of people than a reality, especially if you're living in a really expensive city. We know that rent is just exorbitant for people. A lot of folks can't buy houses anymore, but it's a good way to allocate your income so that you can realize whether you'll have enough to make meaningful progress on long-term savings goals, like buying a house one day or saving for retirement. But for some people, they might not be able to have their rent even in that 50%. So in that case, they might need to pull a little bit from their savings or a little bit from their wants to get it to work. But it's a nice way to categorize the main buckets of what you want from your finances generally.
So 50 to essentials, 20 to savings, and 30 to fun, or what?
Basically, yeah. So 20 is for additional debt payments beyond minimums and savings.
Okay.
And then 30 is the wants category.
How do you find that? What budgeting method have you and the folks at NerdWallet find works the best? Like personally, I've been in finance my whole life. I've never done a budget. I've just adhered to, you know, you save 20% religiously or 15%, and I just have money left over now. So I've just always learned to live, I guess mine's the 80-20 or the 70-10-20 method. So I guess it's probably similar to what you're doing, what you like, but it's not like, I don't think about it that much.
Yeah, I think a lot of people who make a comfortable living don't think about their budget at a very granular level unless they like that sort of tight control on it. Like you may be familiar with You Need a Budget, YNAB. It's a budget.
Everybody loves that. Who's on that?
People love YNAB, and I've had it recommended to me a lot. I've tried it out before, but it's too much maintenance for me.
Yeah, it's a lot of work.
I like understanding at a high level where my money is going. And I do have a rough 50, 30, 20 categorization of how I allocate my money to different accounts because I'm all about savings buckets personally. So I have over 6 savings accounts right now and checking accounts. And so I have certain percentages going into, okay, this is the account where my needs are pulled from, my car payment, my mortgage payment, that type of thing. And then I have another big chunk going to my other savings goals, like my wedding fund or like general house maintenance, stuff like that. So I have it organized in a loose 50, 30, 20, but I'm not tracking every single penny because I don't necessarily need to. If my budget was tighter, if I had greater expenses, I would probably be more attentive to where every single dollar was going. But I do have a pretty clear understanding of how my money is being allocated. It's just not penny by penny.
The YNAB thing, the envelopes. I mean, when I was really struggling, it was just struggling. And then I was saving, and then I was saving, and then I was saving. And I think the key was, so when I was 60 grand in credit card debt starting out, it was really like business debt. I kind of needed it to start my business. I wasn't like profligate, but no one would give me money at 22 to start my financial business. So I used my wife's credit card.
Generous of her.
Because she had credit because I was like a Dave Ramseyite. I'm not really anymore, but I was more into the, before Dave Ramsey with this guy, Larry Burkett, you ever hear of him?
No.
It was in the 80s. Mm. And I was like a 12-year-old, you know, reading these books on budgeting. So I was really into it at a certain age. So like internally, I'm like, I'm not going to spend more on a house than I need to. I'm not going to spend more on a car. So I kind of learned to live on 30 grand a year. So then when I made more, I just saved everything else for a bunch of years until then I had a big kitty to do stuff with. I think that helped me more than anything because then it wasn't like a really, you know, I see these people with the YNAB and it looks really cool. And I would say if you're really struggling and you're into tech, I've heard wonders about that. Cube, there's a bunch of them you've heard about. What's the best budgeting app for people who say, I need a budgeting tool?
It's so subjective, I can't say a specific one. And I think that's why people have to know themselves best. Like, you know that you aren't going to be tracking every single dollar. So YNAB wouldn't make sense for you. But for other people, even if they are making a good income, they just think in that sort of more analytical, controlled way, and they want to see where every dollar is going. So YNAB will make sense for them. So I think it really comes down to understanding what you want from a budgeting system. For some people, they just want to know, hey, is my income going to cover all of my needs and then some? In that case, something more like the 50-30-20 might be a better fit for them because it's more broad, and you can use calculators like we have at NerdWallet to see how your income and your expenses fit into this. But not everyone needs a super granular way of budgeting.
Yeah, and I think in some ways you got to know yourself, right? So if you're going to be, I would find a budget oppressive. I would get nastier. I'd get into more fights with my spouse. You know, just the other day, today, you know, we had our architect over and he was drawing up plans for like a potential new bed. And she's like, you paid that guy that? And I, you know, I would much have rather her deal with it, but she's more of the, she could control every penny, but she just chooses not to. But she has that brain where she would be very regimented. I wish I was that person, but to me—
But you don't have to be necessarily, yeah. Right? You are doing well financially, so maybe you don't need to change the way you're doing.
To me, I'm big picture. So what I'll do is I'll look around tax time. I will look at, well, what did I spend on this category? Should I maybe alter it? Should I alter my behavior? So like one time I figured out how much I spent on Starbucks annually. And that's a lot, you know, when you really do the math, if you're a Starbucks person.
You had your Susie Orman moment and you said too much on lattes.
I don't really agree with her on that. Like she says no to lattes, but yes to flying private. So
right.
She'll
well,
go.
Everyone has their thing. It's just all about your financial priorities, right? Like she doesn't care about a latte, but she does care about a multi-$1,000 private flight.
Yeah, so she can spend $100,000 to go to from New York to Orlando to go to Disney World. That's not me, you know. But I don't want to be scolded for buying a latte, you know, if I want to buy my flat white. But what I did do is I became my own barista. And that saved a ton of money. But I'll still do Starbucks, you know, a couple times a week, maybe three or four times a week.
For me, life is too short to be spending $5 here or there, especially if you have the money to do so. Like, I don't want to be concerned about that. I want to enjoy my day-to-day life because there's no promise of tomorrow. So why not just make the most of it? For me, I get the extra large cold brew, light ice. So that's a good $6 right there. But every time, it's worth it.
So we did travel. We're doing budgeting. How do you think Gen Z and millennials, you mentioned this a little bit ago, can succeed in a world where inflation's so high, where there's high housing costs, increased debt? 7 years ago, there was no inflation, or it didn't feel like there was. Now the world has dramatically changed just about when that generation can buy a house. What do they do?
I think two main things can help people navigate this really tough time is one is recognize how hard it is and try to make the most of it how you can. But also realize that you don't have to do everything. For a lot of people in my generation, my close friends, they realize and they don't really ever want to buy a house, and that's okay. Their priorities are shifting, and so they're allocating their money more toward having an apartment that they like. It's reimagining what they want from their finances, taking steps to get there, and then trying to find less expensive ways to just live in this world. So maybe that's shopping for groceries more creatively, getting that side hustle that you might not want to get for at least a period of time to earn a little bit more cash, but then really understanding that, hey, if you aren't going to be able to buy a house, are you able to go on more vacations because that's what you prioritize more? It's just focused on getting the life that you want from the little money and time that we do have.
Do you think, I've had various forecasters, demographers, the thing that's on my mind because financial planning show, I knew in 06 to give counsel to people to not buy a home, but to wait till 08. 09, 2010 to buy a home because I was in that boat with my wife. I purchased my first home, which was a home I knew I didn't want to be in long term. I purchased it with New Jersey had this 3% down on your first, 3% money down on your first home, which I still think is a federal program out there for first time home purchasers. And there are a lot of good mortgage programs for first-time buyers to get you in the game. So what I did intentionally was buy a house that I knew I could save a significant amount of money with in my 20s. And then when I had enough money to save, I stayed in that house for longer until the market crashed. But it seems as if the real estate market won't crash. I mean, it is cyclical, so it will eventually. I don't know if you study this. Any housing demographic advice? Do you think we'll have a little housing crash in a few years?
I don't see one coming because the demand is still outstripping the supply. And that's the fundamental challenge in the market currently. Even with interest rates, we've been seeing home prices go up this year so far. So I think it's going to continue to be a pretty tough market for people who are first-time homebuyers. But to your point earlier, there are a lot of first-time homebuyer programs that are available at the state and local level that are often underutilized. So if people do want to buy a house for the first time, look into those. I have a friend who was able to get $30,000 to help them with their down payment on their house, and that made it so they could buy a home. And a year prior, she wasn't even aware that this thing existed, but she had wanted a house. So do a little bit of research, see what's an option for you. People might be surprised by what they're able to tap into.
Yeah, there's some great options. I've even heard of where if you're a first-time home purchaser, you could do multifamily. So you can buy, there's this federal program where you could buy like a four family, live in one, rent out the other three. Great wealth building potential. You talk about kind of our last topic, and then I want to ask you just a personal question. You know, kind of what are you passionate about studying in the next few months for your podcast? I like to ask people that. You talk about the great wealth transfer. What is it and what are the possibilities for millennials?
In particular, wealth being transferred from the older generation?
Yeah, I mean, we have baby boomers passing away, their parents passing away, leaving a lot more money to this next generation. So we may see millennials, which were kind of, you know, looked down upon because they can't buy a house. They may inherit $2 million in their mother's 401k or in their father's, you know, TDA from being a New York teacher or something like that. We've not had a generation that has ever had that much money in 401ks, and they're going to be passing away. So that is a great wealth transfer opportunity. Yeah. Have you thought about
maybe that's how millennials will finally be able to purchase homes? That it might take something as unfortunate as your parents passing, but I think we'll see what the world looks like at that point. With I think we have yet to see how climate change is going to play out for this younger generation. There's going to be a lot of migration in this country, so people might want to think about if they are going to buy a home, where is a more resilient place to live? How can they use their funds to shore up their own personal resiliency with whatever kind of funds they have coming their way, either from their job or from an inheritance?
Great. Also, kind of as we conclude the interview, what are you passionate about studying in the next few months for NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast?
Well, I am currently going through the coursework to get my Certified Financial Planner certification, and I'm on the taxes class right now. So that's my personal passion ahead of a test I have coming up. So I'm working to imbue as much of the knowledge that I'm getting from this coursework into the program. And that's my main task ahead of me, is making things that might seem kind of jargony or dense or literally from a textbook that I'm reading and connect them to the everyday lives of our listeners and their money questions.
Yeah, those courses are like watching paint dry sometimes.
So. You know, in a sick way, I'm really enjoying it. It's kind of fascinating.
That's great. Yeah, I love tax law. I can get into, I always find that I learned the most from those non-course related stuff like Natalie Choate on taxes or Ed Slott on taxes and getting into the arcane. Because talking about the wealth transfer, that's going to be a big risk. Like if you're inheriting your mom's 401k, do not take it all at once, because then you'll go from being in a 20% bracket to a 40% bracket, take it out over 10 years, get a mortgage, and then use that to prepay your mortgage or to save for your own retirement. So there's going to be a lot of wealth transfer opportunities for millennials.
Yeah, and that's a good reminder for people to talk with a CPA if they are going to be coming into a lot of money like that, so they can do it in the most tax-advantaged way.
Wonderful. Yeah, talk to a CPA and talk to a financial advisor that is conversant in these issues, because we find that CPAs are just so busy right now. They're just blowing their clients off. So we have two CPAs on staff to kind of answer questions. So it's a good, definitely do tax smart planning. Thank you so much for joining us, Sean Piles. Everybody go download, subscribe to the NerdWallet Smart Money Podcast. I want to thank you so much for joining us, Sean.
Thanks for having me, Josh.